every Arizona homeowner's best friend for 30 years.
And it all has to do with you.
Thanks for tuning in.
It's Rosie on the House.
Back in the saddle again. Good morning, y'all.
Well, I'm riding along.
Saturday morning wake-up tradition. This is every Arizona homeowner's happy place. Come on into my house. It's Rosie on the House.
Ain't got nothing but my name. And I'm the only man I know to
blame.
Here it comes. But I'm living.
Yeah.
I'm happy and I'm free.
Oh, good morning, Arizona. Whatever your cares or concerns are, bring them to old Rosie. My son Romy's here.
And then what's the word for throwing it out the window?
We're going to get to that. Along with my dear sweet wife, Miss Jennifer. Good morning, Miss Jennifer.
Good morning.
We've just finished celebrating our 40th anniversary with a trip through Europe. That was, generally speaking, if I can't get there in my F-250, I'm not interested in going. But we hit Lisbon, Prague, Warsaw, Tbilisi, Georgia. We got to within 4 kilometers of the Russian border. That was so spooky.
Glad we're not there today.
That was really weird. I actually got to peer down and look into a Russian military base bordering, protecting some, what did they call that territory? Georgia thinks it's Georgia's and Russia thinks it's Russia's. A contested.
No man land?
It's a no man land, baby. But we got to look down in right in the Russian camp there. There's schoolhouses and school buses and there isn't a kid on the whole in the whole place.
The picture of those mountains, there isn't a tree or a bush or an animal living. It's living land either.
The Caucasus Mountains, man, they're gorgeous. And we spent some time in Malaga. I always put the L and the G in the wrong place.
Malaga,
Spain. So we had actually a great time. Romy, thanks for covering for us while we traipsed all over the country. So we're back. And the world.
There you go.
The globe. We were globetrotting. But boy, it sure felt good when I got home to put my behind in that F-250 again. I felt so comfortable. So we're back. We're here for you. Saturday morning tradition. And, of course, we have got guests lined up for the 7 o'clock hour. It's going to be a big lineup. Today, we have convinced Dr. David Dean from Grand Canyon University to come in and talk history. Professor of history.
Good morning.
How are you
Glad
today?
You're back. Good. Good. Got your taxes done?
We...
That means no.
We
I'll have to check with my account team and get back to you on that one.
My man's name is Bob, and let's just say Bob and I have spent a lot of time on the phone yesterday.
I think we're going to be talking about taxes a little bit today.
Yeah, tax day. It's that time of year.
Mm-hmm.
And in history, I study successful entrepreneurs, and I study the 18th and 19th century entrepreneurs. And, you know, I could build a pretty good estate.
If?
I didn't have to give 40% of it away.
That's right.
Can you imagine living in a time in this great country where there is no, zero personal income tax? Before the income tax, how did government fund itself?
Well, mostly through tariffs on things coming in.
I like that better.
Sometimes on property taxes, sometimes on sales taxes or licensing taxes. Like, of course, when you tax alcohol like they did in the colonial era that started the Whiskey Rebellion. So people don't like their booze necessarily taxed. That gets people kind of riled up. But the government had, for lack of better, kind of a haphazard way of taxing things, and that was not just planning, but that was upheld by the courts and everything,
so
that you could not get revenue in these, you know, just a blanket one size fits all method.
So you're saying we are now living in a system of 200 years of learning how to tax, and they've gotten very good at it.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Not only of raising taxes, but spending the tax money
and then some.
Did we invent personal income tax?
No, personal income taxes have a longer tradition in other places, but the Western countries, the Western industrializing countries, start to use personal income tax as a way of apportioning taxes more evenly across the board. What that means is that if you don't buy something, then you wouldn't be paying a tax. If you don't import something, you weren't paying a tax. If you didn't own property or transact property, you weren't paying a tax. By having an income tax, that's a way of kind of spreading taxes out. So you don't have to raise as high of taxes, theoretically, because you're putting a little bit on a lot of people.
When did we start it here?
Abraham Lincoln was the great emancipator and the great taxer. In order to pay for the Civil War, he launched an initiative to have a personal income tax to raise funds for the Civil War. But after the war, it was repealed. And we're talking about 3%. Income tax on incomes of over $800 during the Civil War. And now $800, that would be, you know, upper class, middle class kind of people paid 3% of their income. Everybody else wouldn't pay any. And then in 1872,
that's $24.
That was, yeah. And then in 1872, it was rescinded because it was, you know, not necessarily anymore. But as time goes on, big business grows. And again, as big business grows and you're starting to tax property and the holdings of businesses and transactions and whatnot, you're not making that apportionment even. And when we get into that industrial age and government starts to do things, the progressives come along and say, well, we've got to pay for some stuff. We've got to pay for some programs. We've got to pay for kind of fixing what the industrial world is doing. So we need to raise some revenue. So they actually put it as an amendment, constitutional amendment, in Congress to create a flat, you know, income tax across the board, thinking that this will stop this other piece of legislation. They buried it in there. And lo and behold, states liked it. And they started to pass it. Next thing you know, we ended up with an income tax because the Congress underestimated that the people wanted, they wanted government doing these things, doing things that they needed, which we got to talk about why the progressives wanted to do some stuff.
And so that was a progressive movement. Mm-hmm. And a progressive, we couldn't label a founding father progressive.
Absolutely not.
We couldn't.
Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, even somebody like Alexander Hamilton would not have been considered a progressive.
What do you consider a progressive? What's the unique criteria?
So the unique criteria of a progressive is where they start to kind of think about the role of government as helping everybody. Usually the founding fathers thought of government in one of two ways, either getting out of the way and letting people do whatever they wanted, or intervening to make sure that there was a fairness. But that was kind of it. Whereas the progressives come along and see that if you leave kind of a laissez-faire industrial kind of society, business doesn't really act responsibility. Urbanization and the rapid growth of cities and things left a lot of problems in urban areas. And nobody's fixing those. You have government corruption, the Tammany Halls, the Boss Tweeds, and that kind of stuff. So you have inefficient government.
This is all early 1900s.
All late 1800s, early 1900s. And so all that kind of comes to a boiling point where some very smart people, upper class people, got together and said, you know what? We need to figure out a way to solve some of these problems, because if we don't, then we're going to have chaos, we're going to have mobs, we're going to have social problems. And so let's take on things like political corruption. Let's take on the abuses of big business. Let's
so
take
is
on,
Theodore Roosevelt the first progressive?
He's the first progressive president. Progressives actually get their kind of start in the populist movement. So you could go back to, say, William Jennings Bryan. and kind of his whole idea of working with the farmers and the populace kind of thing. But he's the first progressive president, and he references people like, say, Robert Follett and Jane Hull, Jane Addams, sorry, of the Hull House in Chicago, people who were trying to use their resources and their abilities to make things better for the poor, the working class, cities, make things fair for businesses, between business and labor, and all those kind of things.
So they're gonna set up this personal income tax to fund a more robust government that can intervene in these areas that society isn't taking care of on its own.
Sure, an activist type government. But the exchange is, well, let's be smart about it. Let's be efficient. Let's use science to make sure that we're making good decisions. And let's not be pie in the sky. We're not talking about a utopia here, but let's have very practical decisions to very practical problems.
What happened to that?
Then Congress got elected. What's funny is one of the progressive amendments, the 17th Amendment, called for the direct election of senators. Now, previously to that, most senators were elected by the state legislature, would send senators of their choosing to Washington. And that didn't get the people involved very much. So progressives came along and said, no, people need to have a direct say so in that. So they start to create primary elections, and then they would have the people directly elect those senators. And that gets passed into Congress, changing how senators are elected with the 17th Amendment.
And when is that?
That's the same, about the same time frame, 1910 to 1915 or so. And of course, the women's right to vote comes along as a progressive movement that expands democracy, makes things more fair, more participation in democracy. That's the 19th Amendment.
What's a muckraker?
Muckraker, those were troublemakers. Those are people like in the media that would write about problems and issues like Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, which exposes the problems of the meatpacking industry. You have McClure's magazine, which explodes problems, corruption in government and that kind of thing. A guy by the name of Jacob Riis, who wrote a book about New York City and the problems of urban blight and crowded housing and sanitary conditions and health conditions, called How the Other Half Lives. Those are all kind of opportunities that they're saying, hey, there's issues in our society. We need to fix these things.
Here with Dr. David Dean from Grand Canyon University, a professor of history. What's your full title?
Assistant professor of history.
That's it. I knew there was another adjective in there somehow. Another title. Hey, we'll be back with Dr. Dean right after this, talking the progressive era, the fathers of the personal income tax. Have you filed yours yet?